You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Annette Birdsall. So, Annette, the way the show begins is with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about what you aspire to live, what you've done, who you've been, in order to start this conversation?
Well, the easy answer is that I'm the director of the Tompkins County Public Library, and I've held that position for just 4 months.
Uh-huh.
But the rest of who I am is a mom, a grandparent, a quilter, a crocheter, grandmother. So family important things.
Family ties and library and a newbie in this role, but not a newbie in this community.
No, I've been here since 1998.
So what in those labels, in those roles, what are some of the qualities that you aspire to live by or to help others experience?
There's only one rule: be kind.
Neat. Now, today, unlike some times in the past, this show is going to focus on a couple of poems, or maybe more if they become pointed at the time that the way we need to go. So you brought up some poems with you. Would you like to open with one?
I would. This is called My First Memory of Librarians by Nikki Giovanni. This is my first memory. A big room with heavy wooden tables that sat on a creaky wood floor. A line of green shades, banker's lights, down the center, heavy oak chairs that were too low, or maybe I was simply too short, for me to sit in and read, so my first book was always big. In the foyer, up four steps, a semicircle desk presided to the left side of the card catalog. On the right, newspapers draped over what looked like a quilt rack. Magazines face out from the wall. The welcoming smile of my librarian. The anticipation in my heart. All those books. Another world just waiting at my fingertips.
And is this your first memory or one of your earliest memories?
It is not. I didn't have that kind of experience in libraries, which everyone assumes, but I certainly had that experience with books.
Right.
Books where my mom was a huge reader, read hundreds of books and just was always reading. And libraries were a little daunting. They weren't as accessible to me and my family. We were not.
Was it geography or
no,
class,
it
or?
Was poverty.
Poverty, yeah.
It was really experiencing the world, you know, just from a different, different level. And even though books are free at the library, there were a lot of barriers. And so removing those is important to me.
Right. So can you say where did you grow up? How did you grow up? How did you experience? I mean, I grew up in poverty as well, and libraries pay a particular, and there are some stories that I hadn't even thought about. Anyway,
right.
How did that relationship with books come into being, and how did you find your way to a library?
Well, reading is always a good start.
Sure.
And the school library actually had a lot of books, but the way I got most of my books was through Scholastic Books. Mm-hmm. And lunch money spent on books was, you know, a good trade. And also sharing. And I did use the library, but I didn't have that kind of feeling that it was my space.
Right.
So, and then the story of how I became a librarian is a lot more convoluted. I guess I was an English major, a lot of people. Then I had kids and was still trying to figure out what I was going to be when I grew up. And I had an experience of working as a parent educator, which was wonderful. I did craft workshops for preschool kids and after-school kids and taught parenting classes.
And that here in New York or someplace
It was in Norwich, New York, at a place called The Gathering Place, but not our Ithaca Gathering Place. And that was wonderful, and they had a grief and parenting library. And I also worked very closely with the librarians when I developed my themes and read stories during the workshops. Mm-hmm. So then we moved here and for my husband's job. And this is a county rich in libraries, school libraries, academic libraries. So all of that experience with libraries made me start thinking that that's what I wanted to do. And so I started to work in a library at Cornell. And so then it's even more of a convoluted journey about how I got here, but that's probably enough to start.
Right. And so I grew up in rural poverty in Northwest Missouri, and there was a county library And there was a bookmobile that went to every little village and hamlet in the county. Mm-hmm. But if you went to the county library, in addition to books, you got to look at prints of major pieces of artwork.
Wonderful.
And so you got to check out artwork if you were... And one of the things about... my family had the sense of, we had two or three sets of encyclopedias, which my parents made sure that we owned. So I'm the seventh of eight children. And so we all read the encyclopedias as well as the books that we had in the home, as part of just growing up. And then we got out, to other sources. And there was not for my family, the feeling of not being part. As long as we had enough money to drive to someplace, enough money for gas, basically, to get around. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of a different sort of thing. But both my mother had been forced to turn down a scholarship to college because her father needed her to stay on the farm after her mother died. Oh. And so that was her impetus, part of her energy, to make sure that we all got to do what she didn't get to do, which is very kind of powerful. So... you started as a parent educator.
Yes.
And how did you come into that role? That too is something where the state of Missouri actually was one of the pioneer places in the United States by making parent educators available to parents of all newborns in the state back in the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of my kind of being oriented to parenting formally when my daughter was born. So, and she was a poster child for that program in that part of Missouri. So, so how did you discover this role and grow in it?
I started because I was a participant at the Gathering Place. I brought my two children, and then they were offering the parenting classes. And I think sometimes with parenting, it seems easy and you know what to do. And then you think, oh, I got this. And you have another child, and maybe you don't have it quite so well.
Each child is different. Yes.
They certainly are. And so we decided to take a parenting class. And the instructor and I really bonded, and I kept going to classes and learned more and more. And I thought that this should be required. Everyone should take it. And it just helps with communication and all sorts of interactions. So they had a job opening, and I actually started as the workshop coordinator, and then I started teaching the classes later.
Right. So you grew into the role.
Yes.
Right. And when you left Norwich to come to the Ithaca area or Trumansburg.
I lived in Green, Norwich, okay, but it's all the same. When I left that part of the world.
Yes, when you left that, So then you found your way into the Cornell Library system, which is a vastly different environment.
Yes. And it was just libraries that I was interested in. I knew I wanted to go to library school, and so I looked around and said, what's available? And of course, there's 18 libraries on the Cornell campus. Mm-hmm. So that was a good place to start. And I had two middle-aged children at that time. So middle school-aged. Yeah. And they were making their own way here. And so it seemed like a good time to go back, you know, to work more formally. I worked at Joann Fabrics, actually, first I was figuring that out. And then Olin Library had a position for an evening supervisor. And so I did that while I went to school with a lot of other people who were at Cornell going to school at the same time. It was an online program through Syracuse.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Ken Bolton, Cornelia Tencheva, Boris Michel, all my comrades in school. So sure. Jesse Konecki, people still involved in the libraries.
So how does this set of experiences prepare you for what you're doing now with the Tompkins County Public Library?
Well, I've had the good fortune of working in so many different library positions. After I was at the evening supervisor, I did my internships and, you know, went through the school program and what needed to get out of the schedule I had set up at that time, which was working evenings. And by evenings, I mean 7:30 to 11:30 at night, switch that around.
Sure.
And so I took a job as the access services supervisor at engineering. So I did that for a year, but I knew my heart was in youth services that tied back to my parenting experiences and the workshops and all that. So I got a a job at Tompkins County Public Library in the Youth Services Department, which I loved.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not great funding times, and there were hour cutbacks.
Right,
and
right,
so
right.
I said, still like doing this. What else can I do?
And this was a big crisis in the library, I remember, a few years ago.
And then this was back in 2001. Yeah. And then I took a position at Finger Lakes Library System part-time as their youth services consultant. And I also worked for South Central Regional Library Council doing some database training. And so I had all of these part-time experiences.
A cobbled together life, which
exactly
is typical for
so.
This county.
You make your way. Way leads on to way.
Right.
And then I did sort of say, okay, enough pieces, and went straight into being the youth consultant for the Finger Lakes Library System for 7 years.
Okay.
And so then I was ready for a change, and I wanted to get back in the library.
Mm-hmm.
The system is wonderful and serves everyone, but I really miss the library. And so there was a opening in Shermansburg, where I live, and I became the director there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So this then led to this opportunity.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah.
Cool. So, how what are you trying? I mean, it seems I've noticed, and we just talked about before we started the show, that there's been a kind of real increase in the publicity of programming and what's happening in the library, and how, you know, what are you encouraging in your new leadership there?
Encouraging is actually the exact right question, because what I am really all about, the reason I wanted to make this change, was to have the same kind of impact I had in Shermansburg, and that's to encourage access. And the big way where we did that in Shermansburg was to go find free. And a lot of people hear that and don't really understand what that means, but going find free increases access, removes barriers to access. And it is not an abandoning of stewardship. It is the very fact that people who can pay fines have the privilege of doing so, and people who can't don't use the library.
Right. And shame and guilt drives the system.
And I want joy of reading. And it's in our very mission.
Yeah.
Is the joy of reading.
Right.
And so everything we're doing is to increase access. So bringing it back around to programming, it's also increase access. So we have, we're trying to make sure that all ages are served at every stage of their life.
Mm-hmm.
That's also our mission. And so there's been some restructuring to try and make that the emphasis. Those are a couple of the goals.
Sure. That's really, really neat and neat to learn about. Let's cut to music. What should we play, or another poem? What should we go to next?
How about If It Rains?
Okay, so and this is Basia Bulat. How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, not sure.
Okay, it's a beautiful song. Here we go.
Sold a mountain. Could I tell them not to worry if it rains? The road is dry up ahead, but the sun might burn me today. Could the love I had be all grown out? Well, the only way to find out is to hold them where the sun can't dry them out. If I never ask for more, still they say they're sure. But everyone has said those words, even I. It's easier just to run. I'm as hurried as anyone. But somehow you know, when the wind's blowing colder, they'll turn around slower and say to you, I don't mind if it rains. I don't You can leave your friends where you found them, for your soul is still a mountain. You can tell them not to worry if it rains.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Annette Birdsall. So, Annette, one of the questions that I like to put to people is, given the life that you value now, as grandmother, library director, chicken farmer, given the life that you value now, what are some of the lessons that you had to learn to know that this is what you need and want to do? What did you have to kind of experience to be able to find the balance that you're seeking now, to be the encourager that you are now?
That's an interesting question, because I think I, as you heard from my previous conversation, sure, I didn't have a solid plan.
Right.
Of course, I knew what I valued and wanted to work toward that. But I think some of it was more a discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what did you have to discover that you did not know? It's a little bit like a pinball, you know, kind of
right,
bouncing around.
Right. I think that while I had very strong personal goals of family, and I had a creative, very strong creative side. I'm like quilter, crocheter, those kinds of things. I love fabric. I love story. And so figuring out how to put all those pieces together, mm-hmm, and also realizing that the way I could really make meaning in my life, mm-hmm, was to work toward those questions of access, how to make the fact that, you know, I did have those struggles, how do I make that matter for someone else, and learning about how it could all come together. And now I'm so fortunate to be able to work and have an impact just in my, mm-hmm, same role. A lot of people have to separate those, and I didn't. So,
Neat. One of the issues for those of us who come out of poverty or any form of prejudice is learning to let go of the shame associated with that. Because clearly your encouragement, you're removing the fines, and that makes a whole lot of sense. And to anybody who's lived under the gun of those kinds of fines, you know that you can't meet. That's just an incredible burden. How did you learn to kind of be at peace with that experience, to be able to offer other people just without shame or guilt? You know, how did you come around to that? Because it's not necessarily inevitable.
No, it isn't. I do think that I don't think I ever really had a lot of shame, but, mm-hmm, I did have a lot of feeling that there was judgment. And
right,
so how to recognize not to judge, and to recognize what bias and prejudice I had if you did have money.
Right.
There were those kinds of lessons. And I think really it gets easier the older you get.
Sure. And what you've just said is you were aware of the judgment, but since, mm-hmm, you didn't internalize the judgment, you didn't feel shame.
Right.
So the question, right, then becomes different. What about the way you were raised, or your personality just as a human being, allowed you to be aware of the judgment but not internalize it?
For my family, there was always an awareness that it was circumstantial. Education was a way out, mm-hmm, and we just didn't take that on in the same way. So it wasn't part of it.
Right.
So I didn't have to worry so much about internalizing it, but also books saved me.
Right.
When you read a lot of people's experiences, you can, you know, identify with those things that you value.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a circle that saved me.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, and the books gave you the expansive space, but the families that felt that it was circumstantial. The same thing was true in my mm-hmm, family, because my father had also gotten a scholarship to go to college, but he got it after my mother got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And at that, mm-hmm, in 1939, that college was not then an option, or 1940 college was not an option at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But they had this kind of dignity, that these kids are going to do it, what we didn't do. And we were somewhat immune. I didn't become aware of the shame of poverty till I went back home. Well, I came to Cornell on a full scholarship in 1976. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I arrived with two suitcases and everybody else arrived with, not everybody else, but a lot of people mm-hmm. arrived with stereos and all sorts of stuff that I just didn't have and couldn't aspire to. But I also arrived without any debt because I got a full scholarship.
Nice.
Which is an interesting kind of wacky position mm-hmm. to be in. But mm-hmm. I went back home and people said, we never understood how your family lived in that tiny little house that the wind blew through. And I didn't realize that they observed me as being poor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though we lived around people who were extremely much poorer than us, who didn't have proper shoes or clothing or whatever. And we could just barely pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
And but so I wasn't experiencing the same kind of judgment, but mm. the judgment was
okay.
around.
Okay.
The judgment was around. And that's all about that immunization from our parents' mm-hmm. expectations and mm-hmm. their roles.
Yeah. Sadly, the judgment was a little too real.
And too real in, for
yeah.
you.
Yeah. And even in college, I went to Hartwick for my last 2 years, which is a college of a little more money, not certainly.
Right. It's a small liberal arts college,
so it has the sense of privilege. And it was really even professors, people who would say, well, you have to be poor to really have the freedom to explore all these great philosophical ideas. And when they were talking about a character in a book, said, well, of course, let's try to figure out what this person's life is. They couldn't come to this school. And so there were some real, were some real strong bias that they didn't even recognize.
Yeah.
And standing up to those kinds of statements and really forcing someone to mm-hmm. explore why they feel that way. And, you know, that they're actually sitting with someone who may know what it's like to be hungry or to be here on, it wasn't scholarship, it wasn't merit-based, but my dad was a disabled veteran, so I had funding that way. Another path that we don't have to get too far into, but I graduated from a very small 50 kids in the graduating class. Yeah. It wasn't where I started out, where I ended up. And there was money available to students who graduated from that. Mm-hmm. So that's how I paid for my education.
Right.
So so they had to really look at those beliefs.
Yeah.
So
I graduated with 42 other classmates.
Yeah.
We started kindergarten. I didn't go to kindergarten because mm-hmm. my mm-hmm. family didn't have money for kindergarten, which wasn't state provided at the time.
Right.
But we started first grade together and we graduated mm-hmm. together for the most mm-hmm. part.
K through 12, one building.
Similar. Close.
But that was only my senior year. Mm-hmm. So I moved around a lot. Yeah. But
So. And it's the very affluent and the very poor often move around a lot, which is something we don't fully mm-hmm. appreciate. My family was tied to land that they didn't own, but they had to pay. They had to pay on every mm-hmm. year. If they mm-hmm. could, if they made enough money, they could pay on. And if not, they went into a little deeper debt. So that was a kind of a different way of being. How did you find the resolve to challenge your professors?
I think I came by that fairly naturally.
Sure.
I have always had a very strong core and a sense of who I am and what I believe. So that was that wasn't really outside my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
What was maybe the peer, you know, reactions to that sort of thing.
So you're more comfortable challenging the authority mm-hmm, than trying mm-hmm. to deal with the peer.
Yeah, that I kind
stuff.
Of let go.
yeah.
And they can figure it out.
Right. And that's interesting. And for me, I wasn't on an academic scholarship. It was a needs-based scholarship.
Oh, okay.
I think because Cornell at that point didn't give any academic scholarships. So it was clear. And I fit a quota. They wanted people from rural Midwest in the arts college because they didn't have any poor white rural folks.
There you go.
and there was a distribution thing that they were filling too.
Interesting.
And so I felt like a quota kid on some level. Challenging faculty, because I came out of a place where the faith community was very strong and very progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So I was often misunderstood because I wasn't making comments from a conservative Christian point of view. And this was, and I was coming more out of a socialist or cooperativist rural American point of view, where we had lived some of those values, kind of helped. That's what helped us be just barely able to kind of really to experience what it might be like to thrive if we had just a little more stability,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that had, so I made friends, but people didn't have, we didn't have the same experience, and there was no real way. I was kind of an oddity.
Mm-hmm.
And I allowed myself to be kind of the oddity, if you know what I mean.
I know very well what you mean.
Yeah, and I could otherwise pass
mm-hmm.
until
mm-hmm.
I had to take a standard exam.
Okay.
Because you didn't learn study skills coming from a relatively weak rural
okay.
school.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm rambling.
That's okay. It's interesting.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Annette Birdsall. So Annette, what should we go to next, either poem-wise or music-wise?
We could do a poem. We could read The Branch Library by Edward Hirsch.
Sure.
I wish I could find that skinny, long-beaked boy who perched in the branches of the old branch library. He spent the Sabbath flying between the wobbly stacks and the flimsy wooden tables on the second floor, pecking at nuts, nesting in broken spines, scratching notes under his own corner patch of sky. I'd give anything to find that birdie boy again, bursting out into the dusky blue afternoon with his satchel of scrawls and scribbles, radiating heat, singing with joy.
So tell me about that poem. Where does that live in you?
I think that is the heart of the story that I love. That is the feeling of the magic and the independence and memory and experience that you can't have without getting beyond our own
mm-hmm.
selves.
And that's kind of, and to get beyond our own selves, it usually involves some facing something that we wouldn't have otherwise chosen, or that's bigger than we knew it was. So this is kind of my next question. How have you had to change in ways that you would not necessarily have chosen, but proved important?
Well, that is really an easy question to answer. It was very difficult to do. I am a very, very private person in a very public role.
Yep.
And the more I became convinced of being a librarian and the paths that I took, it meant being more and more public. And the value has been incredible, but I have to always recharge and regroup and stay true to myself by, you know, rejuvenating quietly and looking for those experiences.
Right. And so, I mean, and what you're describing in some ways is a deeply introverted person.
Yes.
And which is not exactly a synonym for private.
Right.
And in this culture, we oftentimes confuse those two concepts.
Especially when you're both.
Right. Right. And there's another piece that's really critical here is that when we assume that personal information is private, then we cease to learn from each other.
Yes and no. That's the power of story.
Well, and the thing is, but whose story?
Yes.
And how well is the story told? And we entertain ourselves both with books, but also with like these live storytelling experiences. And they're personal, but they're not private.
Right.
And that's mm-hmm. and that's kind of one of the things that we've lost in my because I grew up in a storytelling culture. And mm-hmm. Actually, they told stories more than they read books
mm-hmm.
and in the grocery stores and on the streets and stuff. And that was partly because this was a community where most of the people were leaving who were younger, and the people who were staying were older folks who had more time, and they had grown up in a culture in the 1880s and 90s and early 1900s where storytelling was the dominant form of entertainment.
It's entertainment, certainly, but it is, I do think you still learn from it. I think you can still connect through shared story.
Oh, and that's what I'm, that's my point.
Yeah, exactly.
The point that I'm, what you learn when you're telling personal stories that are not private
mm-hmm.
is you learn to not gossip.
Oh, and that is so important.
Yeah, and there are two things that kill community.
Mm-hmm.
One is gossip, mm-hmm. and the other is withholding your story. When it's relevant.
Yep. And I would have said, I would have agreed wholeheartedly with gossip. I wouldn't have maybe recognized it as withholding your story, but I could see that.
And because communities are built on communication, mm-hmm. and when we don't have the information that allows us to treat each other with respect, when we don't have the stories that show us the way, which we won't necessarily get from books because they're specific to the individual in very powerful ways, that's kind of my point. And it often gets mm-hmm. lost in our modern culture, where we assume that we can pick up so much stuff in the public realm, but it doesn't show you that individual person or how to approach them or how to navigate what's personal but not private, so you don't overstep and they don't overstep with you. No?
Yeah, maybe. I completely understand what you're saying. I think that there are, and I agree that we need to engage a lot more respectfully and more civilly. But I so believe in the power of story. And however you have to tell it, I think you can learn about an individual through something that's even a little bit removed.
Oh yeah, so, no, that's quite possible. Right. And I also believe that you need to learn not just intellectually, but with the whole range of emotion,
right,
which sometimes is not civil, and with the whole and the range of kind of visceral responses, which are honest, but they're not always easy to deal with because our visceral responses tend to take two forms. One is our reactions, which are mm-hmm. Have to do with fear or anger or things that upset us, but our visceral responses are also those things that we long for, that come out of our core, that we can't justify or explain because they're just who we are.
Right.
And when we have that available in a common sphere, mm-hmm. then we can really be allies. Whereas if we don't have that available, it's very hard to be allied with each other on our lives.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's true. I think that's how we have to look at it. How do you meet someone? And mm-hmm. not as introductions, but really meet them where they are.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I agree.
And know them deeply. And, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. and what I want to respect is that there's something really dear that's lost when the respect for the individual and their personal sense of what's private versus what's more personal and public, when that's violated, there's a real loss there. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to kind of rebuild a sense that we can work together. So that needs to be honored. But in our efforts to assume privacy, we've sometimes lost communication. That's my feeling.
I would agree. Yeah,
But we also sometimes give way too much play to scandal mm-hmm. and to gossip, mm-hmm. which have the same kinds of
right. That's effects. That's not understanding that not everything is public.
Right, right, right.
Right.
And it's just extremes. And using information to harm, to one up or one down people, mm-hmm. which is really.
Not where we want to be.
And it's not what you, and yeah, right. And it's not what a library is about.
Not at all what a library is about.
How do you move through the various roles that you play during the day and during the week or the year? How do you see yourself? Because as an introvert and as a private person, you know, are you moving within kind of a relatively closed space where you reach out, or are you moving in a place where people see you pretty openly, or are you just moving quietly?
I don't do a lot quietly. I do things except for recharging, because that's done that way. But I, in my work days, it's very public, and I'm trying to even be more so. One of the things that I changed was to create a satellite office on the main floor of the library so people can get to know me uh-huh. and get to know libraries better, to know why we're doing what we're doing. It's not really just for the love of reading. It is to create this strong community space for people to engage and get to know each other. And so I have to be part of that space. So, and I am meeting with everyone in the community all the time, and with staff and patrons.
And so you're visibly accessible.
Very, very visibly accessible. And that's another goal, because I'm I think the library's done a great job in the past 10 years or so mm-hmm. to become much more welcoming, but I really want to move that toward belonging. So this is your library. It's very different to be welcomed into somebody's home mm-hmm. than just belonging there. So, right. And this is the community's home, and that's what I really want to facilitate happening. So I have to be visible.
Right, right, right. And I want to pick up on this a little bit, because most of my groups and shared journeys meet in people's homes. Like if the person mm-hmm. is not able to travel, we will go and meet in that person's home mm-hmm. if one of the mm-hmm. people isn't, or the place that we meet is in the home where I raise my kids, mm-hmm. And so around a dining room table, mm-hmm. you know, so it feels familiar. I'm trying to refamiliarize people in that profound sense, mm-hmm. And that is the difference between welcoming and engaging is people kind of have a sense of ownership.
Right.
And they can invite. How do you make the library a more of an engaged, familiar place? Because it can be, the physically, it can be kind of intimidating.
I think that's true, especially if we look back at the poem that I read at first that had the whole structure and tradition and all of those things that if you know all those things, it can be comforting and welcoming. But I would say come to the library. We have new space and we have a teen center and a makerspace and a digital lab, and we have places to just be. Mm-hmm. There's no requirement. You know, the North Reading Room is a place where people wait for the bus and they talk. And it isn't the library that people imagine. In fact, one of our patron comments was they wish that it, you know, was quiet. Well, we have the Ezra Cornell Reading Room for that.
Right.
And we really are celebrating that. And it does require breaking down some traditions mm-hmm. while we're hanging on to what is really important. And so I think we had comedians come on a gallery night February 2nd. Mm-hmm. And they were all making jokes about, oh, we can't do this in the library. We can't do that in the library. In the old library, that's true. But in today's libraries, right. it really has changed. So I guess I have an open invitation to come find out what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and this has been part of a larger transition in the identity of the library. And they had, I mean, in a certain sense, your role in leadership is to take something, the next steps that began before you.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is it's a journey for libraries in right. the big sense, but mm-hmm. also this library and a personal journey as well. But I think that I wouldn't have taken this position if I didn't think I could have that kind of impact.
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm. And I got the first kind of serious inkling when I think Aloja Arawele invited me to come talk about my experience of home. So I grew up in a house that was about 440 square feet. So I stepped off those 440 square feet in the center of the room and asked people to mark that space over the walls. And then I put the inner rooms, and there were two bedrooms, a kitchen, a living room, and a pantry. There was no bathroom. We had an outhouse. But there were six or seven of us living in this space, or more than that, actually. My two parents had a bedroom. My four sisters shared one small bedroom. I slept on the couch or the pantry after I was out of a crib in the kitchen. My younger brother was in the crib in the kitchen or in the crib in the bedroom with my parents. And my older brother slept on the back porch. And that's the way we lived. So people could, by standing up and actually marking the space, they could then inhabit my home. Mm-hmm. There in the mm-hmm. middle of the library, in the middle of the Borg Warner room. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that felt like a powerful way of connecting that I would not have imagined coming from a library.
That's wonderful. It is powerful. That's a great story.
Yeah, yeah. And the other association from my end is that my mother was worked as a nurse's aide after my dad died when I was seven, and she had never worked for money outside the home because they were running a farm together. So she worked for a little more than the minimum wage as a nurse's aide, and then eventually her knees kind of gave out, so they got her a job as an assistant librarian in the school system.
Wow.
And so the thing is she had no college. Mm-hmm. And when they became to when they came around to have standards, she had to give up her job because she had no college and they had no librarian, so she couldn't be the assistant librarian. Aww. So she went and was the assistant director of nursing at the nursing home. Again, for not a whole lot more than minimum wage, but this functional, creative, central community space. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of environment where people live their lives. And what she did, and when she encouraged people to come into the nursing home, was she put them, because she felt older folks need what is familiar, even if they don't, even if they hated their neighbors, those are familiar animosities, and they will live healthier and longer. So she would position people in the hallways that replicated where they had lived in the rural landscape. Wow. So they could be near people that they were close to, as well as those that they didn't like, but it kept their lives as familiar as possible when they no longer could live alone on the farm or as couples.
Yeah.
It's just so, that's so great. I mean, in a certain sense, what you're doing is you're replicating the community by trying to bring it into one location. And we don't do that very often.
Right. And the library also, as an employer and as someone just as part of the downtown business, we take that seriously. And one of the things that really matters to me is that staff recognize that that's what we're doing. We're a living wage employer. We there are opportunities for people who don't have the master's degree. Mm-hmm. There's lots of ways to engage and fulfill your life. And I think that it's really something that maybe people don't understand about the library. And one thing that I'm looking at on that realm is to honor a question that I was asked at a library summit about what would it look like if every decision were made with compassion. I don't know the answer, but I am exploring the question.
And what does the exploration of that question look like?
Part of that exploration is getting to know the staff on a personal level. I'm meeting with everyone and just asking them to tell me their story, tell me what they know about the library, because it's certainly different than what I know. So having conversations is the way to...
And you're pushing kind of a boundary issue there about personal stories, but also in some places where we really know each other, you end up going into the spaces of people's homes if you're invited. And then that's where the if is, but also the openness to the possibility that this might be good.
Right. You can make the invitation, and hopefully, you know, there's trust and respect so you can have the conversation. Sometimes the answer might be no.
Right.
And that's
okay. Right. And the point is that it's not so much what the answer is as that it's the openness to one another.
Yes.
And the answer can change over time. And in either direction,
right?
For good reasons, but that means that you have a more honest relationship, and people don't want to be vulnerable when they don't want you in their house for whatever reason, or they're open to that vulnerability and sharing in a way that allows certain things to happen that wouldn't otherwise.
Right.
So, shall we play your One Summer's Morning?
Sure. Just a second? I just thought that would be great for a wintry day to.
Yes.
Take a break.
Yes. And it's Dougie or Doogie McLean?
Doogie
McLean on the fiddle.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to jump in here. I just have to, you have to have a whimsical
appreciation for the paradoxical to do community work.
Right, right. And I'm going to, because if you don't have a sense of whimsy, the sense of the hypocrisy is so painful that you can't always continue to do the work.
True.
So this is kind of an interesting segue, and let me do the idea again. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Annette Birdsall. And Birdsall, I get the pronunciation there. I get self-conscious, and then I get funky. The question that I like to close with is, how did you learn that your self-care was your job, not somebody else's? And what do you do to do that emotionally, intellectually, physically, so that you can restore yourself? And how do you know you need to?
Right. Well, I think, again, I was fortunate in the sense that I always knew it was my responsibility. I was, one of the side effects of growing up in poverty is that the resources even of family aren't necessarily enough to go around. I was a middle daughter, spent a lot of time caring for others, and I was the one who needed to care for me. Sure. So I recognized it early on, but that's a blessing. And so I knew what I needed, and I knew how to restore myself with quiet. I keep a commonplace book. A lot of people don't know what that is. It's not a journal. Mm-hmm. It's writings that I enjoy and that appeal to me in a moment. And when I go back and read them, I can actually recall how I felt in a moment, and much better even than my own words. And that generally it's poems. Sometimes it's just something that struck me about a particular writing. I swim, and I, of course, now we have a puppy, so I take her out and walk mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. do all of those things. And it helps if I get to the ocean every year.
So, yeah, yeah.
And I know I need it because I just can't keep going if I haven't taken the time to, really pay attention to mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Again, fortunate to
right,
know that.
Right, right, right. So in taking a role in leadership in libraries and being a deeply private and a person who's more introverted than extroverted, you have to play a role. I mean, a lot of professional actors are introverts, and they can make that transition because they learn how to do that public persona. What have you had to learn to kind of be the person that's out there?
I think that for me, it's again one of those paradoxes. I really enjoy people. I thought that I would need a job where I worked alone and did not enjoy those positions. So mm-hmm. I had to really recognize what it is. And I do. I love people in all their contradictions. Mm-hmm. And I love the mission of making the library theirs and really making it a place where everyone belongs. And so to do that work, I had to really recognize that part of myself mm-hmm. and to be open to sharing that and figure out ways to honor the other. So I don't see it as so much a role, although certainly you have times where I call it you're really having to draw on that energy. So what I have to do is restore that mm-hmm. to be able to do mm-hmm. it. And I really had to learn to honor that in a big way
right.
to be able to do this.
Right. And one of the things that I've learned from people who study introversion is that introverts have much closer personal relationships. It's mm-hmm. a quality of being introverted is that you will form deeper attachments, but fewer of them.
Correct.
In general.
Correct.
Yeah. And that you have, it was a big shock to me when I was facilitating groups to discover that I was facilitating groups of introverts. And they desperately wanted to connect to others, but they needed an excuse to come meet together. And so giving them that excuse then allowed them to do what they naturally did, even though they may have been people who, when they were 50 years younger raising children, were had no use for each other because they were judgmental. But by now they had lived enough life that they could welcome each other and walk into their lives, into their struggles with a real love and respect for each other.
Yeah, living enough life, I think, is key.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
We have major institutions here in both the library and in the History Center, and they have a way of helping us to develop the capacity to relate to each other and to develop an understanding of the possibilities, the failures, and the opportunities of history. How do you see the library helping us to face a future together, especially in times where, you know, we're perceived as kind of an island of ideological irrelevance on some level or idealism, but how do you see the library helping us to face our future together?
Well, I think it's similar to the History Center, where you look back in celebration and acknowledge what is wonderful and you want to keep, and you look back to see what you need to change. And I think the library and the and even that process of working toward honoring your history, but moving forward, is the role of the library is to recognize that we're creating history right now. Mm-hmm. Everything we do is history. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be in the moment.
Right.
And so
we're living it.
So, and we help with that. We have those resources that help us archive what we want to keep, mm-hmm. and learn from what we don't need. And I think, you know, so we're natural partners, but again, it's living that life.
Right. Right.
And
right.
examining that as you go along.
Right. And so how one of the biggest issues in community is helping people to understand the joy or the sorrow of other people where they do not value the life that they live. How can you bring people into some kind of appreciation? I mean, with books, you can do something from a distance, but how can you see this as a process of cultivating community?
Well, I think that's a really great transition to what we also do in the library. Books are our brand, that is who we are, and story right. is so important. But what we really do is offer people a space to come together and have those conversations, and we have the resources to do that. People come to the library to find people to meet with, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. converse with. Their groups come, and we learn from each other. Our space is used by everyone, and as long as we keep honoring that this really belongs to the community, it's a resource that is well supported by this community, and if we continue to use it and have those conversations, we're really facilitators of that understanding. Right. So
it's incredibly important what you do. What I want to, and framing it in that programmatic sort of way gives us a picture of how it works structurally. But how does it work when a community has to face both its grief or its failure to live up to its own ideals? Or how can the library help that? We don't have strong cultural or religious institutions. We're a community of fragmented many communities in many ways, and so in a certain sense we don't understand each other's suffering or each other's joy. How could the library help us with that process? Or is it just primarily a platform where people can come and do that if they're so inclined?
I don't think it's a platform. I think it really is a space that encourages mm-hmm. that. And so, yes, there are the programmatic pieces of that, but there's no requirement. You don't have to believe any particular thing mm-hmm. or be part of any particular organization. And people naturally do see it as their space. And we see that as every level. Parents are coming mm-hmm. together. You may have an issue you want to talk about. There's and we've seen this in libraries over and over again when it is community. community grief. It's the library that stays open, the library that's there for people. And so, and without any other judgment. And so if we make it a space where you are welcome through all of that, and we are as open as we can be, I think that is our role. I think that we have evolved to really recognize that that was always happening in libraries, and now we're celebrating it.
You also brought one final piece of poetry. What would you like to close with?
I did, and this poem is by Naomi Shihab Nye, and it's called Because of Libraries, We Can Say These Things. She is holding the book close to her body, carrying it home on the cracked sidewalk down the tangled hill. If a dog runs at her again, she will use the book as a shield. She looked hard among the long lines of books to find this one. When they start talking about money, when the day contains such long and hot places, she will go inside. An orange bed is waiting, story without corners. She will have two families. They will eat at different hours. She is carrying a book past the fire station and the five and dime. What this town has not given her, the book will provide. A sheep, a wilderness of new solutions. The book has already lived through its troubles. The book has a calm cover, a straight spine. When the step returns to itself as the best place for sitting, and the old men up and down the street are latching their clippers, she will not be alone. She will have a book to open, and open, and open. Her life starts here.
Neat. Neat. The line that just leaps out at me from this poem is, the book has already lived through its troubles. The book has a calm cover, a straight spine. We need to have the assurance that we can live through our troubles.
That's true.
And that, as a country, I think is what we face as a challenge. And it's good to get to know you, Annette. And thank you for taking time to be on the show.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.